to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
During her career as a professor of political science at Chico State University, Michelle Shover researched 19th century history in Butte County. Her latest book is California Standoff, Miners, Indians, and Farmers at War, 1850 to 1865. Michelle Shover, welcome.
Nice to be here, Nancy.
Well, you got your PhD from Tulane University in 1968.
I did.
That's the same year you came to Chico State University to teach here. Is that when you got interested in local history?
No, I wasn't interested in local history for another almost 10 years. And one reason I was put off by it was that it didn't seem to amount to more than John Bidwell. Everything was centered on John Bidwell. Other people were known for their relationship to John Bidwell. And it didn't seem, you know, it didn't seem like a comfortable American story that one person would be the sole figure of any consequence. But when I bought an old house and people asked me about, you know, who had built it, I didn't know, but I did think, well, I do know how to do research. So I did that, and I discovered that there was a very remarkable individual who had owned that house. And so I started doing research on him, and I began to discover all kinds of things that I'd never heard about here and people who were remarkable or sometimes troublesome. You know, it got very interesting, and then I began to find stories and themes, and I began to track issues that I'd never heard anybody write or talk about. So those went to a collection of articles, which I've published earlier. And by the late 80s, I thought, well, how much can you say about a town of 4,000 people?
1980s, you know, now,
the
since we're going to be talking about
the 1980s. Yes, 1980s. My 1980s. So I was about to move on to something else. But something called my attention to the Indian settler issues, and I thought, well, I've seen so much stuff about that. What more could anybody possibly find or say? But a local history professor, when I asked her about Indian things, where should I start if I wanted to just feel out a topic, she recommended a book by Albert Hurtado. And I found in it things about this area that I had never heard about and citations in archival documents. So I thought, well, I'll just go to those documents myself and see. There were extensive correspondence in 1850s written on Bidwell's ranch about the Indian situation, and I just kept going. I would go from one thing to the next. It did get, it took me a long time to do this because the information, while it was substantial in some ways, there was a lot of detail that was important to recover. And I really did look far and wide, and I had the advantage of there was some historical writing done. The Magliari book, for example, is an excellent look at Bidwell's perspective on history here. And
who is also a professor at
University. History, very fine guy. But I also looked at anthropology. And I found that early 20th century anthropologists had come up here and had made a point of interviewing the oldest Maidu they could locate, which would take them to the period of Indian settler conflicts. So that's what I decided to do. And I became interested in the subject, if you'll excuse me just a minute, because I just wanted to know that one period. My interest wasn't total about Indians and settlers, but I wanted to know why it took so long for that contest over territory to be resolved. territory was not really held firmly by either side between 1850 and 1865. For a time, some people would hold it, other people would attack it. It went back and forth. No one felt secure. And in fact, many people just fled. It felt so dangerous. Or in the case of Indians, they were simply shoved away.
Well, I might remind listeners that your degree is in political science.
Yes.
And you are a professor in the department and chairman of the Department of Political Science. So your research ends up being in history, but a PhD means you're a trained researcher.
That's how
and
I
so
understand it, yes.
So you found this topic that intrigued you.
Yes.
And off you go. I might remind listeners that this is retired professor Michelle Shover, and her book is California Standoff, Miners, Indians, and Farmers at War, 1850 to 1865. So what you were just alluding to is the fact that this is a standoff.
It was. Neither one could actually hold in security the property they had. Now, by the 1860s, of course, Bidwell was solidly in charge of his ranch. However, even in the 1860s, he was in the thick of the contest over Indians and settlers and trying to resolve the clashes. So he was not free of that issue at all until everyone else was.
Well, if we have a standoff, then who are the parties to this standoff?
The principal parties, because Butte County is my focus, but I learned that Tehama County's history is very much the same. It's the same issue. It's the same front. But the parties were principally Maidu and, of course, the settlers. Now, what was distinctive and contributed to the standoff was that both sides were divided among themselves. For example, the settlers were divided into miners and valley farmers, and they were very competitive, didn't like one another, felt one another was too successful and not deserving of it, and tried to stymie one another in the use of county funds. The Indians, the Maidu, as the name came to be, were a very divided tribe. They were divided.
In fact, you used the word triblets.
Well, they were looking at it first as a tribe. That would be from Plumas to the Sacramento River, from Deer Creek Canyon, say, to middle of Yuba County, something like that. There were all these Indians that we now call or have for some time called Maidu. And they recognize that name Maidu as well. However, those Maidu were divided first into two parts. There were the Valley Maidu and the Mountain Maidu.
And they were quite different in temperament.
They were very different, and they were deadly rivals. Within the Valley Maidu and the Mountain Maidu, it's not a favored word in anthropology today, triblet, but you almost have to use that word in talking about this particular tribe, because it was made up of, I would say, hundreds of little groupings with their own territory, and they were pretty much family groupings. 100 people wouldn't be unusual. The Concow were the biggest. They had sometimes 1,000 people. And so they had their own territory, and they were constantly on alert against one another.
Well, if they were divided, the Mountain Maidu mm-hmm. and the Valley Maidu, so geography divides them?
Geography divided them.
What about language?
Language divided them extremely much because some of them could not understand a tribe at 50 miles away. They shared certain aspects of language, but they did have a lot of trouble communicating. And I might add that they also were different in that although they were both all territorial, they had to treat territorial issues differently. For example, the Indians down here on the valley floor, they were the Rockefellers of the tribe, really, because they had this lush area with fine soil and moderate climate.
So they had no trouble having food, enough
That's
food.
That's right.
Whereas
so
the had, mountain,
yes,
Maidu.
They had territory, but they could never resolve their needs within their own territories. So they all understood that they traveled back and forth among themselves in the mountains.
So and starvation lurked in
Yes, absolutely. They had to do a lot with very little. And sometimes, and since they were all dealing with a little space, a little amount, they warred on one another, and sometimes they collaborated. For example, the territorial thing was so important that you literally could not cross a territory without being in fear of your life. If you shot a rabbit and that rabbit crawled across the territory, a line, if you went after that rabbit across the line, your own life was at risk. So there was a lot of counseling of children, never cross this line, never do that. So territory then was important to settlers. It was important to Indians. And, of course, they were all fighting over the same territory.
So there was this intense traditional rivalry
yes.
between the mountain Maidu and the valley Maidu.
Yes, and that had gone on for many years. And the tactics that terrified settlers used by the mountain Maidu, the tactics were terrifying. They had always used those tactics against one another successfully. And so when they turned those on settlers, settlers were equally afraid of them. And so even though settlers had guns, Indians were extremely capable in the use of arrows. And so settlers were never feeling secure around Indians during that period of 1850 to 1865.
My guest is retired Professor Michelle Shover. Her latest book is California Standoff, Miners, Indians, and Farmers at War, 1850 to 1865. And one, I don't know if I want to call it a weapon, that the mm-hmm. settlers had against the Indians was diseases.
Yes, yes. Well, and settlers were dying of them too, but that they certainly did pass those diseases. And I might add that more Indians died of disease, like contagious diseases or alcoholism, that kind of abuse, than in war, in these conflicts. The conflicts created a lot of Indian deaths, but it wasn't anything compared to what disease cost them.
Well, when the settlers are viewing their enemy, these Indians, I don't see how they kept the cast of characters straight, because it's such a cliche that to the Indians, all white people looked alike, and to the white settlers, all the Indians looked alike. And in fact, you have some wonderful photos in your book, mm-hmm. Michelle. I enjoy these photographs.
You.
And so one of the first photographs I came to of some Indians, a row mm-hmm. of Indians, and I looked into their faces and I thought, golly, they do look alike. I could see how the settlers would have trouble knowing, well, which Indians are these?
And that's the way they felt looking at us, how do you distinguish?
And because I looked at the white faces in that same photograph and I thought, these white guys look alike to me.
That's
too.
True. So even if they wanted to reciprocate by killing a particular person, they couldn't find, so they would reciprocate against somebody, and that would satisfy justice.
So they were killing each other, but there was a reason that they often spared women and children, because what could become of them? They could be quite useful.
Yes. Well, women and children, they needed women. They like to save women, usually, and did, because their communities needed women, and men like to have women around, fortunately. But it was a very difficult situation for women, because they could be easily kidnapped, grabbed, used as booty for war and became slaves. Essentially, that's correct. And children, of course, then could be used as well. I might add, too, that neither side in this conflict had any allies of much use. For example, the Indians sometimes allied with one another. They more than they used to. They began to have more contact with one another to help one another. So sometimes that worked. But they always had to negotiate their relationships. And on the settler side, people might reasonably think that, well, the settlers had the army. The army came up here. So the settlers must have, had everything conceivable they would need for a victory. But the problem was that the army was sent up here and stayed here in Chico, but the army never protected the settlers. The army was set up here and based in Chico to protect Bidwell's Indians from settlers who had been attacked in the foothills. And foothill farmers blamed Bidwell for protecting Indians because some Indians on his ranch had, from time to time, participated with mountain Indians in raids.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. After a break, we'll continue our conversation about California history. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is political science professor Michelle Shover, who has written a book, California Standoff, Miners, Indians, and Farmers at War, 1850 to 1865. And we've been talking about Bidwell, but just for the people who might not know who this founding father is, tell us about John Bidwell. Before he comes on the scene as this huge figure here in Chico.
He was born in New York, came west in the Bidwell Bartleson Party, the first party to come to California, I gather, and worked for John Sutter for a while. And while working for Sutter, became exposed to Indian labor, which was central to the success of Sutter's farms. He learned to farm on a grand scale instead of on an eastern.
Because most of these settlers had small farms.
That's right. Most settlers had small farms in the east as well. But he saw that Sutter could put together this enormous ranch and with that labor force create a real, almost an industrial model. And so he thought that he could do the same when he came across this property and was able to buy it with gold that he brought down from the mountains using Indian labor.
Yeah, you say in your book that 100 Valley Indians mined gold for Bidwell and a couple of other men and made these three men quite wealthy.
Yes, and they mined that gold in Mountain Maidu territory. Now, Mountain Maidu would never have allowed Michuptas to come up there. And yet there they were for a whole summer mining away. And they did attack the party and did kill one of Bidwell's Echupta laborers. So this was always an issue. The Mountain Indians tried to drive Bidwell away. They knew the size of his operation was quite a challenge. And so they would come down onto the ranch where they would, they attempted to murder several of his laborers.
Well, you know, one thing that occurred to me too is I'm wondering, okay, what did the Indians get out of this? They're working, working hard for John Bidwell. And then you tell us how he paid them. And I thought it was rather amusing that if they were a good worker, they got two red handkerchiefs a day, and a regular worker got one red handkerchief a day. But also, how else did he pay his workers?
Well, he provided food and clothing.
You mentioned cigars.
And cigars.
Scissors, which I thought, oh, that's interesting. So he also paid his workers in cigars, scissors, and you mentioned clothing. And then it seems like a cliche, but beads were status symbols to Indians.
They were. And one of the issues that the federal government dealt with was pay for Indians, how to pay for the land. And one of the things that everyone understood was that Indians didn't understand money. And so if you paid them in money, it didn't mean anything to them. And if they had money, it was likely to be stolen by other white people. You know, so
whereas the white person is not going to steal a red handkerchief.
No. Well, and so it was something Indians accepted for a while. They became gradually, of course, more sophisticated. But they were always a low-wage workforce. Over time, and of course, Bidwell took that on. And over time, while he kept them working, I think he put more into their tribe than probably got out of it in the long run. But they were his total workforce in the 1850s, practically. And so he owed a great deal to them.
Well, a lot of times you think, well, we go to the chief if we want something done, if we want the Indians controlled, we'll talk to the chief. But the Maitu didn't really have that sort of hierarchy. And so the white settlers, and this is my understanding from your book, said, okay, what we'll do is we'll get these maroon dress jackets with brass buttons, and we'll select some people who seem like they would be leaders, and we'll give these jackets to the leaders. And did that idea pan out?
Well, it was an idea. Antoinette Martinez told me this. She's an anthropologist on campus, that the Russians had done this over on the coast. They gave special military jackets to the leaders to try to create some headmen so that they could have some people with more authority to deal with. And it did appeal to them here as well. And I did find that picture of one of them wearing one of the jackets.
Yeah, I saw that photograph. And then also it was amusing that then these other Indians who weren't getting the jackets said, hey, well, we'd like a jacket too. So there was a run on these.
They were quite flashy, you know, and understandable that they would want to have their own. And they didn't understand probably these other people being picked out ahead of them, since that wasn't the way their culture operated. We were just talking about the problem of alliances. When the military was up here, even in a campaign in 1859 to remove Indians to a reservation and to quell some of these clashes, the military would not go into Deer and Mill Creek canyons because they were so difficult of access, and Indians were hiding everywhere, invisible but always present. And they were frankly afraid, and they couldn't do anything by conventional army regulation there. And so they just avoided it. So anytime the military came up, usually they stayed here, right close to Chico. But if they did ride out, anyone who wanted to protect himself just melt into the canyons. So settlers really didn't have support.
Well, and sometimes the settlers jump to conclusions, oh, the Indians did this. So You mentioned in your book that one time some cattle wandered off, mm-hmm. and the settlers, the Mountain Maidu stole our cattle. And so they go off and they kill 12 Indians. And what turned out to be the actual truth?
Well, what happened is that this is in 1858 in Tehama County. A big rush of raids on farms took place. And that had happened historically with Yahi coming out, raiding in the foothills. But in 1858, the farmers looking at this problem saw a change in the pattern of what had happened. And that was that these Indians were stealing things that Indians in the canyons didn't use. They were stealing, they would go through a whole corral of horses and they'd pick out the best horse. Or they'd go into a herd of cattle and they wouldn't pick out the bottom of the barrel. They would pick out the best cattle. They would even steal tack. And horses were of no interest except for food to Indians. They liked to eat horses better than cattle, but they didn't ride. They always climbed canyons and that sort of thing. Very fit people. And so what they speculated was, in Tehama County, the farmers, were these Mountain Maidu? They didn't have that name for them at the time, but were these, and they speculated they were Mountain Maidu because Mountain Maidu were raiders and because they lived with whites. They were surrounded by miners.
Miners.
And so they spoke English. So they communicated with miners. They had Indian women companions, and so they're kind of an integrated group up there in some respects. But how to find out? How to figure that out? Well, they did hire a pursuit party, and the pursuit party did come across a dozen Indians. They didn't kill them. They followed them. They tracked them. They tracked them north to the border of the Pitt Rivers, and that's a very fierce tribe. So they didn't go further. So they turned back, and they kept being followed by this pursuit party. And they blended with a lot of other renegade Indians around a lake. And the party waited for them to move out again, followed them again, and some of them went into Butte County. So this began to legitimate this speculation that some of these Indians actually were from Butte County, Mountain Maidu.
So it was actually the cattle had just wandered off, and they assumed that it was that they had been stolen by the Indians.
Well, they were stolen. Were stolen by Mountain Maidu instead of Yahi.
Say the Mountain Maidu wouldn't confront their enemy directly? What would they do?
It was a brilliant tactic because it shielded them. The tribelets each, they were relatively small. So their warriors were very precious, and they were very careful to protect them as best they could and to maximize at the same time their access to their opponents. So it really frustrated the settlers and the military, too, that the Indians were keen surveillors. They were always watching, but they would never make themselves visible, or very rarely, or if they did, they knew to be a certain distance so that rifle fire couldn't catch them.
And they would attack in daylight, broad daylight.
That's right. One of their strengths as raiders was that they attacked at the moment of dawn, when there was just enough light to get in, to see what they needed to see, to act and leave quickly. And of course, at the
so they would kill their opponent. They would take prisoners.
Yes, and their opponent,
their goods, whatever they wanted to steal.
And the victims, you know, they were sleepy. They were confused. They weren't very stable on their legs
because this
yet.
Was a surprise. They weren't expecting this to happen.
So it was a specialty of theirs. And in fact, someone once said, an observer named Powers criticized the Maidu men because, or the Valley Indian men, because they seemed to sleep most of the day, and the women were always doing all the work.
In fact, one observer said that they would sleep 14 to 16 hours out of 24.
Well, and
so they
at
were
the, but
drowsy
at the same,
and seemed to be sleeping.
And
in
the reason, yes, and I think that one of the things that one of the reasons they stayed up all night and gambling helped them stay awake and alert. Was that they needed to be alert at dawn because their own opponents would tend to strike then.
Well, so not only were their work habits a problem from the white point of view, but also their sense of time was problematic.
Yes, they when a treaty was offered to them as pay for their lands, they were to go to a reservation and have all kinds of goods. And so this was a promise that the government made to them in a treaty meeting at Bidwell's Ranch. And they liked the idea of these goods. And so it appealed to them that they were kind of intrigued and maybe they'd sign. And so they wanted the goods. And the army that had come with the commissioner had come with big freight bags on mules. And so they thought all these goods he was talking about were on those mules in those big freight bags. And the commissioner was really frustrated because he kept saying, no, this will happen later after some, you know, several other things happened first.
And the Indians didn't, they weren't used
no.
to that. What do you mean? Somewhere down the road this is going to happen? Nah, no way.
Exactly. Yeah. They just didn't have, they had a completely different concept. So this was something that caused frictions also.
So we were just talking about the men, the Valley Maidu, seemed to sleep during the daytime. They seemed to be drowsy and mopey. But then what about the role of women?
Well, the women, Indian women, have always been well known for their endurance, I think. I wrote a little bit about that. So if you don't object, I'll just read a little bit here. Traditional tribal life afforded Mechoopda women and girls few opportunities for leisure, similar to other tribes across the
Whereas the men did have leisure thanks to the women's industry.
That's correct. Similar to other tribes across the state and continent, while men assisted in berry and nut collections, most food preservation and daily cooking, as well as making clothing, child rearing, basket weaving, the packing and transport of goods from one site to another, fell to females. A grueling sight that caught Power's attention was the elder women's use of stone pestles to pound acorns in hallowed rock matatas, hour after hour, under full summer sun, while everyone else napped. In addition to their traditional responsibilities, women's labor on the ranch included digging the ditch from Butte Creek to Bidwell's flour mill.
So this is something that I was surprised, that they the traditional work of Mechoopda women and girls was to dig ditches.
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't the traditional, but I mean, they did their usual work. Plus
this.
On the ranch, they were assigned to dig ditches.
So far, they sowed grain sacks, gathered winnowed wheat, picked fruit and vegetables, and other crops. Now,
my guest is Michelle Shover, and she was just reading from her book, California Standoff, Miners, Indians, and Farmers at War, 1850 to 1865, and you were saying that the women,
the settler women also.
Yeah.
I just had a paragraph here about that,
okay,
too. Rural wives felt especially unsafe because of Indians in the neighborhood at a time when there was a lot of conflict. They felt especially unsafe because the need for additional income forced their husbands to find jobs elsewhere, and such as Chico, mining camps, or Oroville, for days at a time. This left the women with the added responsibility for their husband's farm work, while they continued making virtually everything their families used. Mary Murdoch Compton was so busy with work at her home on the Yanaseco Ranch, where Indians were not a threat, that over 11 years she went to Chico only a few times.
So not only were the Indian women expected to work
constantly,
but also the white women,
the
settlers.
Women, yes.
But also, I was rather surprised that they wanted the Indians, back to them, they wanted the older people to be useful.
Yes.
And so what jobs did they assign to the eldermen?
They were pickets. This was an Indian tradition that Bidwell then used. In the tradition, the elders who didn't have the strength, of course, that they at one time had, they were placed at the corner. They were put to live at the corners of territory where they were to be the observers. When Bidwell came along and other farmers, he put those elderly Indians in the same place. They were to be the fences to keep the cattle out of the wheat fields. And the idea was then that if they saw this crossover, they would run and get help, and then the fitter people would take care of the problem. But if they failed and didn't do this, they could be beaten. That was the older tradition. And I doubt that Bidwell allowed that for very long once he knew about it, but he didn't say any more than that he was aware of.
Well, now, you're mentioning Bidwell and such mm-hmm. a huge figure in the history of not yeah. just Butte County, but of California. You'd think historians would be knocking on his door saying, Mr. Bidwell, we'd like to interview you. But historians did not do that.
Well, it is strange because he had really valuable experiences they would have benefited by knowing. In his later life, he did go to conferences and make talks about his experiences. But no one came and offered to do a whole biography. So fortunately, he and Annie did make a practice of sitting down together, and he would remember for her, answer her questions. So we did get a kind of a memoir. It's
now
not
you
very
say
long.
Kind of a memoir, because I'm just imagining the two of them sit down. Here's prim and proper Annie yeah. Bidwell from Washington, D.C., who is very specific about what she thinks is right and wrong. And here is Bidwell. I'm just thinking he had to probably do a little self-editing for the benefit of his wife who's taking his dictation.
That's why I qualified when I said that, because it's valuable. Even as it is, it's very valuable. But it struck me so many times that I believe he would have spoken more fully about some of the things he did talk about or mention, except that he was protective of her because she said to him that she was so, her sensibilities were so delicate that she could not take a Methodist church ceremony. It was just too much for her to
She
handle.
Was Presbyterian.
Yes.
She was Presbyterian, and she was too sensitive
she
to
was
go
a very
to
sensitive
a,
woman.
A Methodist. Well, I sometimes, in reading your book, wonder, gosh, how did John Bidwell even survive attempts on his life?
Well, you know, when I started all this years ago, I started looking at all these other people. And I've found great interest in them, and I've found a lot of contributions they made. But this particular study that I've done gave me a kind of sympathy for him, even though he did things that, you know, were not really very sensitive and we might object to. I don't know how he would have survived if he were any different kind of person, because he had to be very stubborn. He was absolutely committed to his vision, and he let nothing stand in the way. And he did some very questionable things, like he called for the removal of Indians to the coast in 1863. He paid for that removal.
Now other settlers wanted to retaliate against Indians.
Yeah.
And Bidwell hesitated to do that.
Well, he didn't want them to retaliate against the Indians, that's for sure. And so he brought tremendous pressure. Well, we have to put this in order. He put pressure on the Indian agent in Northern California and on the Secretary of the Interior in the spring of 1863 to remove hundreds of federal Indians, which were temporarily camped here for reasons I won't go into. But he wanted them out of here, and he told them that they must remove those Indians. He had done what he said. He kept them for the winter. He didn't want to keep them any longer. And he mentioned they were sick. The Secretary of the Interior did nothing. The Indian agent said, I'd like to, but I can't find a place for these Indians. Well, by the summer, a terrible crime took place in which children were killed by Indians, and the Foothill farmers were just livid about it. And there was something that happened in that crime, or in reports of it, that insinuated that there was some Valley Indians involved. So Bidwell was getting the pressure from the farmers that he was responsible somehow for this. And so he called up the Indian agent. The Indian agent came. They all agreed. Farmers, 150 farmers vowed to go raid Bidwell's ranch if all of the Indians were not removed to the coast, including Bidwell's Indians. And that's where Bidwell wouldn't have it. He said, take every other Indian, you know, but mine stay. Now, that went against the thinking of the Indian agent, the military. But at the same time, they deferred to him in the end. And his Indians did stay, and the others did leave. And he had to pay for the wagons because none of the other farmers would help.
You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. After a break, we'll continue our conversation with Professor Michelle Shover. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Well, now, I mentioned that I was surprised that John Bidwell didn't get killed because the Mountain Maidu tried to assassinate Bidwell. This is 1856.
That's 56, right.
And they ended up, his poor ranch miller looked like Bidwell,
yes.
And they ended up killing the miller on Bidwell Ranch.
And the arrows all configured in the same spot. They were all aimed at that man who looked like John Bidwell.
And yet, apparently, John did not want to tell Annie that they came to kill him, that he didn't want to tell her, these Indians came to assassinate me. She just told her that, well, they came to the ranch to trade.
Yeah.
But as a consequence then, the Mill Creeks did quit raiding. And I mentioned Mill Creeks because when you're reading along your book, it gets rather confusing.
I know.
Michelle.
It was confusing then.
Let's see now. The Creek Indians and the
Butte
Creek and the Butte Creek. And
it's just that the Butte Creek Indians were the Maidu warriors, and the Mill Creeks were the Deer Creek warriors, or the Canyons of the Yahi. And their warriors were called Mill Creeks.
Well, you know, I didn't feel so bad when I read that the settlers also had trouble with all these different tribal names.
Well, they did. Eventually what they did is the name Butte Creek just disappeared because the Butte Creeks, in a really brilliant strategic move, moved their bases of operations for raiding out of Butte Creek, out of Butte County, across the ridge into Deer Creek Canyon. So when they raided out of Deer Creek Canyon, they were just called Mill Creeks.
Well, now, you say that the after this failed attempt to assassinate Bidwell, that they changed their strategy.
Yeah, this is it.
And they had three objectives in changing their strategy: to restore winter access to the valley's foothills, to find replacements for Butte Creek Indians that were killed in conflicts, mm-hmm. and then have a haven, safe haven for staging ground for their raiders.
See. And that's why they then became called Mill Creeks, because they were now coming from over there, not from Butte Creek.
So when they changed their locale, the name, their label changed.
And even one of the Indian pursuers, Robert Anderson, uses both names.
Well, also something I had never heard of. The Maidu fighters sometimes wore stick vests.
Yes.
And I imagine, okay, in the Middle Ages or, you know, they had metal vests in Europe. And how were these devised?
There were sticks about an inch around, and then they were sewn together.
So the Maidu fighters wore these stick vests. And they were specially designed to have high necks. And what good were those high necks?
Well, just so the arrow wouldn't catch them in their necks.
And you said they could duck their head into
the vest. And they did that, too, yes. Uh-huh. And then I thought it was interesting, too, that that on both sides, the young children would run out and pick up the arrows when they took breaks, which sounds kind of a dangerous journey to send your kid out on. But so they had it's interesting because that was how they did have these formal, you know, face-to-face battles, but they were very organized and everybody was ready for them. The viewers were there, the fighters were there. But on a day-to-day basis, they used these more subtle approaches. And they were very successful because people would go into those canyons and they would say, "We knew the whole time we were being watched, but we couldn't do anything. We couldn't see anybody."
Well, there was something interesting happened in Forest Ranch, and I'm just wondering if present-day residents of Forest Ranch have any idea of what went on in the summer of, I think it was 1858?
I think so. I think that's one of those, that is one of the incidents that did survive historically. But what didn't survive is all that led up to the pursuers finding the Indians there and what they were looking for. And those were the pursuers trying to figure out whether the Indians who attacked Tama County were Yahi from Deer Creek or whether they were Mountain Maidu. When they focused on them and traced them right to Maidu territory, then they attacked them. And they attacked actually the whole camp that they melted into.
In Forest Ranch.
In Forest Ranch. So the people killed did not just include the bad guys, so to speak. But that vindicated in their minds that it was Butte Creeks raiding out of Mill Creek Canyon.
When the Civil War comes along, there were fights breaking out in Chico, and which Bidwell called Chico Village then.
Yes.
And in fact, in your book, you include a map of Chico Village in 1862, and it was called Chico Village. And during the war, for example, two Union men claimed that they were victorious. They fist fought seven local Confederates. So these two guys beat out seven local Confederates. And then in front of Bidwell's hotel, these rebel rowdies would ride back and forth saying, "Hurrah for Jefferson Davis."
That's true. The Chico was very divided, actually, in the war. About 40% of the population was Southern or borderline Southern. Well, that is from Kentucky and Tennessee.
Speaking of another photograph in this section that you have about Chico Village, you have an interesting photograph of a cattle gate across Broadway, downtown Chico. Here's a cattle gate so that they could drive the cattle through on their way to summer pastures.
That's right. I love that picture because also in that picture you see on the right Bidwell's store.
Yes.
And which is now a Mexican restaurant. Which is
Tres Hombres is in this very building.
So you're looking at Tres Hombres.
In your photograph.
Yeah. And on the second floor of that building is where very hot public meetings took place over what to do about these Indian raids killing children. And in those meetings, Bidwell became very engaged and subject to tremendous attacks because other farmers resented his having his own personal workforce of Indians, and yet at the same time being the leading union advocate against black slavery. So he had slaves as they saw it, but they weren't allowed to.
Well, I do want to just very briefly, we've only got a couple of seconds left, but how did Bidwell get an invitation to dinner from General Grant?
I just don't know how that came about. But Bidwell was very, he was a well-known California figure, and he was appreciated in the new Republican, as a new Republican in California, where they needed to.
So he visits Grant in his tent.
Yes.
And Grant invites him to dinner. And you also say that Grant probably got only 15 minutes sleep that night.
That's what he said, yeah.
And out here in California, the Chico Union men were cheering, for example, when Sherman captured Atlanta. And then Bidwell comes back to Chico and he decides to launch a campaign for a nomination as a candidate for the House of Representatives. But this was such an interesting time.
It was.
During the Civil War here in Chico. And I know people who like local history will really be interested in reading your book.
Thank you, Nancy.
The book is California Standoff, Miners, Indians, and Farmers at War, 1850 to 1865. The author is retired Professor Michelle Shover. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.